Last time we covered the first two parts of the five parts of Hilchos Nida. We covered how a woman becomes a Nida. We covered the Harchakos, the extra separations there are between husband and wife when she is a Nida. And we covered, that's it, two out of five. Tonight, we need to cover three things, and hopefully we'll have time for all three. And they are the Shiva Nikim, the seven clean days, Mikvah, and Vestas, calculating when she's going to get her next period. Those are the three parts that we have not covered yet. So we will start with the Shiva Nikim.
My section is expandable or collapsible, so don't feel pressed.
Okay, well, we'll see. I mean, yeah, okay, we'll see what comes. When a woman is done bleeding, then she can begin counting the seven clean days, the Shiva Nikim, provided that there has been a separation between the husband and wife for at least 5 days. There's a 5-day mandatory separation time. That means that there have to be 5 days minimal that the husband and wife separated because of halacha. I'm making a distinction, not 5 days of voluntary separation, but 5 days of separation because they felt they had to. Now, that would mean even if, let's say, a husband and wife had a shiloh, and they had nobody to ask. So because they had nobody to ask, they separated for 2 days. And then they finally found the Rav, and they asked, and the Rav said it was really okay. They didn't have to separate for 2 days, but they did. And then right there, or shortly afterwards, she gets her period. So then they have to separate anyway. And she bleeds for 3 days. And then she stops bleeding. At that point, she could start counting the seven clean days because they separated for a total of 5 days and it was a halachic separation. It wasn't a voluntary separation. They separated because they were afraid that maybe she was prohibited. And so that would also qualify any separation which is halachic in nature counts towards the 5 days. Those 5 days are counted. You count the day that they began to separate and the day that she starts the Shiva Nikim. Those five, you count all 5 days. So let's give an example, and we'll use this example throughout the first part of this discussion. Let's say that on Sunday, in the afternoon on Sunday, we're going to assume that Shkia these days is about 6:15, 6:20, something like that. So let's use 6:15 as our Shkia. So she began to bleed on Sunday at 5:30 in the afternoon. So that's still Sunday, because it's before Shkia. So that's day one. Now Sunday is day one. Monday is day two, Wednesday, Thursday. Did I skip? Sunday is day one, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday is day five. If she has finished bleeding by Thursday or earlier, then Thursday afternoon, before Shkia, before 6:15, she can begin the process of the Shiva Nikia. There's your 5 days. Obviously, if a woman bleeds for more than 5 days, then she naturally waits more than 5 days. But if she bleeds for less than 5 days, she has to wait the minimum of 5 days. Once that 5-day waiting period is over, or more, then she can begin the Shiva Nikim, provided the blood has stopped. So, in the afternoon of the day that she wants to try to do a Hefsek Tahara, she wants to begin the process of the Shiva Nikim, then she will, before Shkia, and it's recommended to start with a little bit of time before Shkia. If Shkia is 6:15, let's say 5 o'clock, something like that, then she will do a Hefsek Tahara. So what she will do is she will wash up. She does not have to take a shower. Some women like to do that. She doesn't have to. She just has to wash up. And then she does a bedika. And a bedika meaning she takes a cloth and she does an internal check as opposed to an external wiping. It has to be internal. And if the cloth comes out okay, then that is an acceptable hefsek tahara. Assuming the hefsek tahara comes out okay, then she waits until Shkia, and at Shkia, which for argument's sake we're saying 6:15, she will use a moich dachuk. A moich dachuk means she takes a cloth and she crumples it into a ball and puts it inside into the vaginal canal and leaves it there for the period of time from Shkia until Tseis HaKochavim. Tseis HaKochavim in Atlanta is 35 minutes, correct? 35 minutes? Okay, so 35 minutes. From Shkia until Tseis HaKochavim, she leaves the moich dachuk in for that period of time. Then afterwards, she takes it out, and if that moich dachuk also is okay, then she can begin the Shiva Nikiyam. That's the process to start her off, and then she can begin the Shiva Nikiyam. So in our example, Thursday afternoon, let's say around 5 o'clock, she did a Hefsakara, she did a Bedika, and it came out okay. Then at 6:15, she put in a Moch Dachuk, left it there for 35 minutes until 6:50. She took it out, and that was also okay. Now, Friday is day one of the Shiva Nikiyam. So Friday, Shabbos, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of the following week is the last day of the Shiva Nikiyam. And that night, Thursday night, the following week is when she would go to the mikvah. So that's the simple process of the Shiva Nikiyam, the 5 days in the Shiva Nikiyam. Now, there are many details which we have to cover. During the process, you have a question? We're probably going to cover, but here, go ahead.
But we talked about, you guys are talking about right at Shkia. But they're able to start in the afternoon before Shkia.
The Bedika was done, the Hefsekara was done before Shkia. I said around 5 o'clock, for argument's sake.
Right, right.
Then the Moch Dachuk, right, which is the second step, is done at Shkia.
Well, the second step is what it could be done before
Shkia. It could be done earlier and left in until after Tzei Sakochavim. It just means keeping it in for longer. It has to stay in until Tzei Sakochavim.
It does.
Yeah.
That's the process.
Right. So you could put it, she could put it in as early as she wants. It's generally not so comfortable.
You put it in before.
No. It's not 35 minutes. It's from Shkia until Tzei Sakochavim that has to be in. Right. Now, during the Shiva Nikiyam, which means in our case, Friday through the following Thursday, though during the 7 days, she does two bedikos per day, once in the morning after sunrise, which in Atlanta can be pretty late. But it's after sunrise in the morning, and once in the afternoon before Shkia. So twice a day, through Thursday, through those 7 days, and then she'd be ready to go to the mikvah that Thursday night. So the total amount of bedikos she is doing, including the Moch Dachuk, is 16. There's the Hefsektara, there's the Moch Dachuk, and then 14, two a day, during the Shiva Nikiyam, for a total of 16 bedikos. Now, the bedika cloth, they sell cloths, as you all know, and that's obviously acceptable, but it doesn't have to be a cloth that you buy at the mikvah. A woman could take an old undershirt and cut it up, and that would also be good. Anything soft and white can be used. A garment, soft and white, anything like that is acceptable. When she does the Hefsektara, which has to be done, as I said, before Shkia, that Hefsektara needs to come out okay. We'll define what okay means a little later on. If it comes out and it's not okay, she could try again, as long as it's not Shkia yet. So if she tried it first at 5 o'clock and it was no good, she can try again at 5:30 or at 5:45 or at 6 o'clock. But once she gets to 6:15, then it's too late. So she needs to do it before Shkia, and she can try again if she needs to. It is recommended that she not try too many times, because it's easy for her to irritate that area of the body, and if she irritates that area of the body, it will bleed. And if it bleeds, it's going to be a problem, even though that bleeding is not uterine bleeding. But nevertheless, when you look at the bedika cloth, the Rav is not going to know whether it's uterine bleeding or whether it's from the canal. And therefore, we're going to have to say that it's no good, because we don't see a clean cloth. So it's recommended that she not try too many times. Two, three times. If it doesn't work after two or three times, she should wait a day till the next day. It's not recommended to do more than that. The Hefsektara can be done earlier in the day, that first bedika. It could be done earlier in the day. It is best if it is done in the afternoon. If a woman is not going to be able to do it in the afternoon, whatever's going on, she can do it as early as the morning of that day, provided, of course, the bleeding has stopped. But that would be if she can't do it in the afternoon. L'chachila, it should be done in the afternoon. That would be the best thing. Then, of course, as we mentioned, is the Moch Dachuk, and then we have the twice a day during the Shiva Nikiyam. Now, it is fairly common for a woman to have problems with irritation with so many bedikos, with these 16 bedikos. That's fairly common. It's almost universal that it happens at some point in a woman's life, for example, after childbirth or after just getting married. It's very common that there be a problem with irritation. Some women are naturally have irritable skin, and therefore they have trouble all the time. So there are several lines of defense. Obviously, we don't want her to be irritated. That defeats the whole purpose of the bidika. So we don't want that to happen. So there are several lines of defense. The first line of defense is for her to lubricate before she does the bidika. Using any of the over-the-counter lubrications, KY jelly, something like that, would be acceptable. The way to do that is one of two ways. She can either apply a little bit of it to herself. If she does that, then she should wait about 10 minutes before doing a bidika. Because the problem is, if she does a bidika immediately after lubricating, the bidika cloth will simply pick up the lubrication. And it'll mask whatever colors are there. So she should wait around 10 minutes, let it get absorbed a little bit, and then do the bidika. The alternative is to apply a thin layer of lubrication to the cloth itself, which could also theoretically work, and then do a bidika that way. That would be an acceptable way of dealing with irritation. Bear in mind that KY jelly, that particular lubricant anyway, the thickness of it can be a problem with Shabbos. And so if there's a Shabbos issue, that should be a rav should be consulted about that, about how to deal with that sort of thing with Shabbos. If irritation is still a problem, then the rabbi should be asked. Because if the rabbi deems it necessary, he can instruct a woman to diminish the amount of bidikos that she does. But that should always be done through a rabbi and not on one's own. Really, one should do 16 bidikos. If there's problems, speak to your rav, and if he sees it's necessary, then he can tell you what should be done if necessary. Yeah.
You're not worried about the mumdug of it causing it sings out of the size of it, and you're not worried about it causing bleeding or anything like that?
It can cause irritation. That's usually the first culprit. Is the moch dachlok. The other ones may not cause any problem.
I'm not talking about irritation, I'm talking about bleeding.
From what?
Well, it's the same thing. You said that because of the size of it, that it's more than an irritation.
It may. Which, if that would if a woman is prone to that, then a rav should be consulted.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. It's common that a woman could be irritated by it, and therefore it should be.
When you say irritation, you're talking about bleeding.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought you just meant sore.
Well, usually the soreness in that area will cause some sort of bleeding. Even a little bit of blood will get on the cloth.
I just understood your
question. Yeah, you're correct. Thank you for pointing that out. Yeah. It should also be noted that a moch dachuk would be considered carrying on Shabbos. Meaning a woman can't have a moch dachuk in and go out of the Erev on Shabbos. So if the Erev, chas v'shalom, is not, not working, not, we don't say it's down. Okay. If it's not usable that Shabbos, then she can't, if she's doing it Friday night, she can't go out with
the
moch dachuk.
Same luck with a tampon?
No. No. Because a tampon is dealing with, it's going to be too much to get into today, but that would be okay. But a moch dachuk would be a problem. Now, yeah.
I'd say that this is not my question, but I guess I assume a pad as well.
It's okay. Yeah.
What does that mean in English?
That's the cloth that is crumpled up in a ball.
It is, but what does it mean?
Moch means a soft piece of material. Dachuk means tight.
Hebrew.
Yeah.
Hebrew. You really should pronounce moch dachuk.
Right.
I still wouldn't know. Okay. Was it Aramaic?
No.
Hebrew.
Yeah.
Okay.
If a woman forgets to do any of these bidikos, so she meant to do them, she forgot. So almost always it will be okay b'di'evet, meaning she shouldn't forget, but if she did, it will almost always be okay. There are three that she absolutely must do. And the three that she absolutely must do is the very first one. That's the hefsek tara, the one she does to start the process off. The first day, she must do at least one. And the last day of the Shiva Nikim, of the 7 days, she must do at least one. Those three must be done. But everything else, if she forgets, will be okay. But as I said, she should try not to forget. It would be better that she does them. If she did forget, let's say she forgot the afternoon one, and it's already past Shkia, then, okay, it's too late. There's no point in doing it after Shkia. That's already too late. But she should try to get them all in if she can. At the end of the Shiva Nikiyam, then she's ready to go to the mikvah. And that would be the next topic. Any questions about the Shiva Nikiyam, or the seven clean days?
Yeah. Will you discuss later on what happens if during the seven clean days something there is bleeding, and how long you have to wait after that?
Thank you very much. Okay, I left out a complete section. Thank you very much.
I don't know what happened earlier.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Left that all out. Okay. During the seven clean days, she should wear white underwear. During the time that she is permitted to her husband, we neglected to mention this last week, it would be better that she wear colored underwear. But during the time of the when she's doing the Shiva Nikiyam, she should wear white underwear. Any time that there is a shiloh, which means there's some sort of question, either the cloth itself has a color on it, and that color may be reddish, may be darkish in some way, then, or that her underwear has that color, then you need to take it to a rav to find out whether it is asur or mutter. Now, if it is a color that is clearly, it's like a very, very faint yellow or something like that, it has no darkness to it at all, there's no reddishness to it, it's just a yellowish color, that's okay. Anything else, you're going to want to ask, because you're going to look at it and you're going to say, that looks bad. And then, most likely, and this is a very common thing, a woman or a husband will look at it and say, that looks bad. I guess it's no good. I guess we'll have to start over. I guess we'll have to start again, or whatever it is. If you take it to a Rav, the Rav who has been trained in checking these maros, checking these shilas, these questions, will be able to discern whether or not it has the color that is no good or a color that is good. It's a little bit tricky to know the colors. And if you haven't been trained, it's very easy to make a mistake. So it is best to take it to a Rav. Rabbi Feldman can, obviously, you take it to Rabbi Feldman. You can also take it to me. You can take it to Rabbi Parnas. There are various Rabbanim who can look at these maros. It should be noted that in the larger Jewish communities, any Rav who looks at maros, not all Rabbanim do, let's say a Rav who's colorblind, then obviously he can't do it. But the Rabbanim who look at maros, they can get hundreds per week, or even more, because everybody's constantly bringing them shilas. It's very, very common. It's not something to think, oh, that's so weird to take underwear to the Rav to look at. It happens all the time. Regularly. It goes on everywhere in Klal Yisrael. It goes on all the time. It's not something unusual. It's not something strange. It happens everywhere. Now, the women, understandably, are somewhat inhibited from taking it to a Rav. And that's why the husband should do it. If the woman is not inhibited, she could do it too. But it's like taking out the garbage. It's the husband's job to take the shalos to the Rav. Using a white sheet is recommended. It would be proper for a woman to have a white sheet on her bed when she is doing the Shiva Nikiyam. If a woman is in a place where that would be difficult, let's say you're traveling, staying at somebody's house or whatever it is, it would be okay in a traveling situation not to use it. But if you're at home, and if possible, she should use the white sheet. That would be appropriate for her to use the white sheet. If during the Shiva Nikiyam, one of the bedikos or the underwear has a color on it and it comes out that it's no good, then she needs to start over again. In a case that she would have to start over again, there is no need to wait another 5 days, because there were plenty of days already of separation, of halachic separation. So there's no need to start the 5 days again, but the 7 days have to be restarted if there is a no good color during that time. Thank you very much for pointing that out. Okay, what else do we miss for the Shiva Nikiyam? Okay. Yeah, you're wearing white underwear. Wearing and having the white sheet. Right. Did we mention that?
Just the ifs, ands, and buts. Oh,
she doesn't have. Right. Okay, all right. If she doesn't have the white sheet, that's for sure okay. If she doesn't have white underwear, she should at least wear we all wear, clean underwear. I mean, that's the not to wear underwear that has a stain on it. So you can tell whether there was a stain or not. But lechachila, she should definitely have white underwear to wear during the Shiva Nikiyam. It won't invalidate the Shiva Nikiyam if she doesn't have it. But it would be very highly recommended that she use it during the Shiva Nikim, during the seven clean days. Now, at the end of the Shiva Nikim, so in our case, so she counted from Thursdays when she began, so really Friday is the first day. Thursday afternoon she did the Hefsekara, Friday she began, so Friday, Shabbat, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday afternoon is going to be her last bedikah, and then Thursday night she's going to go to the mikvah. Now, for the mikvah, there's two parts to the mikvah. There is preparation for the mikvah, which we call chafifa, and then there is the actual tevila, that's actually going into the water. The preparation for the mikvah can be somewhat tricky, and there are various. There's what you want to do optimally and what is second best over here as well. Optimally, and this is the very top, you know, as if you can really get it in, this would be the best way to do it. The preparation should be done during the day. Not at night, but during the day. And optimally, she should go to the mikvah immediately after finishing the preparation. But she can't go to the mikvah until after Tzeis HaKochavim, until it's nighttime. So if you put all that together, let's say in our case, that Shkia would be around 6:15, and let's say Tzeis HaKochavim is around 6:50, so she should begin the preparation around an hour or a little bit more before the time that she could go to the mikvah. So in our case, if 6:50 is the first point she can go to the mikvah, she can actually go down into the water. Then she should begin the process at least at 5:50 or a little bit earlier, maybe 5:45, 5:30, begin the process of chafifa preparation. Do that for an hour, a little more than an hour, then go to the mikvah and go down. That would be the number one top way of doing it. For almost everybody, it's impossible to do that on a regular basis. Maybe once in a while it can work out, but it's very rare that a woman can work it out. Either her schedule doesn't work out, her husband's schedule doesn't work out, the kids, or the mikvah schedule doesn't work out. She can't get an appointment at that time. So the question is, what to do when you can't get in all of these factors, where they can't be done in that way? So it is best to prepare during the day. That is more important than preparing right before going to the mikvah. The daytime preparation is more important. So if a woman is able to prepare during the day, even if afterwards she'll have to wait a few hours before she's ready to actually go to the mikvah, that would be the better thing. So if it's the middle of the day and she's able to, she's not working, she's home, she's able to do it, then that would be the best thing. Prepare it then, and then keep from getting dirty during the few hours between the time that she finishes and going to the mikvah. Then that night, she will go at her appointed time to the mikvah. When she gets to the mikvah, she will just check herself. Maybe she'll take a shower, she'll comb her hair again, but the bulk of the preparation will have been done during the day. And that would be the optimal thing. Most women can't do that. Most women are either working or they're busy with other things, children, whatever it is, and it's impossible for them to do that during the day. So therefore, almost always these days, a woman will do the preparation at night. She'll make her appointment at the mikvah, and she'll go in, and many women don't have the facilities to prepare at home, or they don't feel comfortable preparing at home. So most women will make their appointment at the mikvah, they will go to the mikvah, prepare at the mikvah, and then go down, and everything done at the mikvah at night. That is acceptable. But if it's possible, then these other things would be a good idea. Yeah.
What's the earliest time during the day that would be acceptable?
She could theoretically prepare first thing in the morning. But it just means that a long time, I'm sure she would be uncomfortable doing that, because I mean it would mean a very long time.
All they have is morning time. They have 10 to 12 open, and that's it. Until then they have a 10 o'clock at night appointment. They should do it then rather than doing it
at 9 o'clock, right.
The bedikah could be done later.
I mean, you don't want it to be that she went through the whole preparation and then the bedikah came out bad, but it's rare that a bedikah on the seventh day is no good. So that would be acceptable. Again, a woman may say that she's uncomfortable doing that, she's afraid she's going to get dirty in some way, whatever it is, you know, so whatever the reasons are, if she's more comfortable at night, she can do that. But all things being equal, the daytime would be a better time to do the preparation. Now, the preparation involves it should take at least an hour. If it's taking less than an hour, then perhaps she should speak to the person who taught her or whatever it is to find out maybe something should be done a little bit more thoroughly. The bath should take about a half an hour, and then there's the other things, cutting the nails and getting rid of the makeup and all whatever else the woman has to do. It ought to take around an hour. The chafifa that is done, the women have a checklist, and they know, and when they go to the mikvah lady goes through the checklist with her, so they have it all, you know, they have it all down, and they know what they're doing. But but a husband has to be sensitive to the fact that it's a lot of work for her to do this preparation. And therefore, whatever distractions are going on, a husband has to make sure to help his wife out, that she should be able to have the peace of mind and have the time to be able to do the chafifa, to be able to do the preparation calmly. The whole reason why it's better to do it during the day and at night is because during the day she won't be rushed through it. At night we're afraid she'll rush through it. Maybe she wants to get home faster. Maybe she's nervous because it's the nighttime. So we don't want her to be in a situation where she's rushing through the process, which is meant to be a meticulous process. When mikvah comes out on a Friday night, or on a Matzai Shabbos, or it comes out on Yontif, so that can be somewhat complicated. The preparation cannot be done on Shabbos or on Yontif. And so it always has to be done, if she's going to be going to the mikvah on Shabbos or on Yontif, the preparation has to be done necessarily before Shabbos or Yontif. So if she's going to go Friday night, then she needs to prepare sometime on Friday during the day. She has no choice then. She must prepare sometime during the day on Friday, which can make preparation for Shabbos pretty hectic, more hectic than usual. Again, husband has to make sure to be sensitive to that. The preparation needs then to be done during the day, and then she makes sure not to get dirty in any way, and then that night when she goes to the mikvah, she will just check herself, make sure there's no problems. The mikvah lady will check her, and she'll actually go down. If she's going to the mikvah on Matzai Shabbos, here you have a difference of opinion in the poskim, because some say that, well, she should do the preparation during the day, which would be Friday afternoon or Friday morning, something like that, and then go to the mikvah Saturday night, which is more than 24 hours later. Others say, well, that's such a long break between the preparation and going down, therefore, better for her to do it on Saturday night. There is a difference of opinion over here. I don't know how Rabbi Feldman rules over here, so I'm not going to stick my neck out.
But just the last thing.
What's better? Go Friday afternoon or Matzai, or go prepare Friday afternoon or Matzai Shabbos when she's going on Matzai Shabbos.
Tell them to do Friday afternoon and then do, obviously,
like, and do a touch up on Friday night. Okay. So, on Matzai Shabbos. So the best thing then is to do it on Friday, to do the preparation on Friday, and then to do a touch up job on Matzai Shabbos when she actually goes down. If, of course, she's not able to do it on Friday, then it's like any other time, she would do it on Matzai Shabbos itself. Yeah.
If you have like a 3-day yontif,
yes, that's the next thing. Let's say it's a 2-day yontif, 3-day yontif. So it's the same thing, meaning that if she's going to go on yontif or on Shabbos, she has no choice. She has to prepare in the afternoon of erev. Let's say yontif is Thursday and Friday, and then there's Shabbos. So let's say she's going on Friday night, but she can't prepare on Friday. It's yontif. She can't prepare on Thursday. That's also yontif. She'll have to prepare on Wednesday in order to go on Friday night. That is perfectly acceptable. Perfectly acceptable.
I don't understand the preparation then, because she obviously is not going to be clean 3 days later.
She will be clean from whatever is going to retard the mikvah process, meaning that she will be clean. She will have combed out her hair, and then most women'll clip their hair. They'll put it in a clip to keep it from getting all tangled. They will be clean enough for the mikvah. They will make sure during those 2 days they're not going to need any dough, which is anyway prohibited on Yontif. They're going to make sure to stay as clean as they can over those 2 days of Yontif. Women get very nervous about it, but it is perfectly acceptable in halacha. Woman just has to be careful. And before she actually goes down, she has to do a thorough check. She can wash off whatever parts of her body need to be washed off, and the mikvah lady will check her as well. But it is perfectly acceptable to do that. If she's going Motzai at the end of a 3-day Yontif, so in our case, Yontif is Thursday, Friday, and then there's Shabbos, and she's going on Motzai Shabbos on Saturday night, so now the question we had before becomes even greater. Should she prepare on Wednesday afternoon to go to the mikvah on Saturday night, or should she prepare on Saturday night to go to the mikvah on Saturday night? Again, there is a discussion about this. My understanding is it's the same thing, that it's best to do it on Wednesday afternoon and then to do a touch-up job on Saturday night. That's not as nerve-wracking for a woman, because on Saturday night she could take a shower. So, you know, she can comb her hair again. All that can work out. It's just that she does the bulk of it on Wednesday. She doesn't have to take another bath on Saturday night. So that's not as nerve-wracking. But whatever it is, it's done. and you should know that it's done. It's not unusual. It happens all the time. Women go to the mikvah every night of the year except for Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. And so every Yom Tov women are going to the mikvah somewhere in the world. So it's done. That's all there is to it. When going to the mikvah, what she actually does in the mikvah itself, the women know the process. There's not that much need for the men to get involved in what they do over there. They go down, they make a bracha, they get checked. Yeah.
The wife wanted me to ask a question. She said every mikvah she goes to, they always give the women a doily to put on their head when they go down in the water, and nobody has been able to tell her why. They give the women the doily.
Well, I've never been there, so I can't tell you 100%. I mean, one possibility is they have to make sure the hair gets under the water. It could be that it helps get the hair down under the water. Every strand of hair has to get under the water. So it could be that's just a way of making sure all the hair gets down. Maybe it's for covering for a bracha. I don't know. What would be the reason for...
I can't imagine because...
Well, she doesn't have to.
I suspect that there's no basis for it, and that people think it's just making a bracha, they have to put on like a female yarmulke or something. I don't know
where that comes from. Okay, I don't know either.
Did she say this one again?
It could be a washcloth, it could be something
a towel is usually given to keep the hair down. So that when she goes up, usually it's to keep the hair weighted so that when she goes down.
No, that's not true. Not a woman's different.
Yeah. I don't know the answer.
Why does a woman not have to cover her head when she says bracha? This is an interesting question.
Your daughters don't cover their head.
I'm curious. I know, but I'm saying why is that?
Yeah.
They have their eyes going in there, and that's why.
Whatever the reasons are.
Their arm is otherwise also. And their arms are covered, shoulders and all.
If a woman comes out of the mikvah and discovers that there was something that was a chatzitza, there was something that was a separation between herself and the water, if it really was there before she went down, then she would have to go down again. But it's a very rare thing, because the women are so careful with getting ready, and the mikvah lady checks her. It's a very rare thing. Sometimes you have the case of the very nervous woman who will, after she comes out of the mikvah, notice all kinds of things that were on her body, and maybe going to the mikvah was no good. Not an uncommon thing. My wife's grandmother is a mikvah lady in Queens, and she complains about this all the time. The person who taught me Hilchos Nida when I was a chassan recommended, and I assume he recommends this. He's now a rav in Detroit. It's Asher Eisenberger. So he recommended then, I assume he still does, that a woman after she comes out of the mikvah, like when she's driving home or whatever, after she's out, should eat something that is a little sticky, let's say an orange or an apple or something like that. Get something on her hands, get something between her teeth, not to mask anything, chas v'shalom, if there really was something there, she'd have to go again. But we're so sure there really wasn't anything there, this will put her mind at ease, because if she discovers something later, she'll, oh, that was from the orange, that was from the apple. And so it's a recommended thing. If your wife is the nervous type, this might be something to recommend so that you don't have these issues later on.
Yeah, it's actually brought down, because it's actually brought down at the shop, because it ends up shtering the chazaka, so when she finds a shtering the chazaka, later on she finds
she can just blame it on that. Yeah, she can blame it on that. That would be the easiest way to do it.
Could you just take 1 minute to elucidate on Iyun in Chafifas? Because I find very often that Iyun is not appreciated as a separate...
Besides the actual Chafifa, besides preparing, but to check their bodies. Okay. So, I mean, again, the process of checking, but to look in the areas... Right, so they have to, okay. So the basics of the preparation are the bath and combing their hair, cutting their fingernails, cleaning their teeth, cleaning the very, very, the very first layer inside the ear and inside the nose. Many a woman has given herself an ear infection by doing too thorough a job. That is something just the very, very inside of the ear, just a very, very slight, just right inside the nostrils, should be cleaned. The navel, the belly button, the areas like that, anywhere where there's a fold of skin to clean and to look at to make sure that there's nothing there. And that would be the process. Although I believe the mikvah lady goes through a checklist, that's what I assume goes on to check those areas as well. That's what I assume happens. And that, as Rabbi Kalman is saying, that establishes a chazaka, that makes it that we assume that she was okay when she went down. Therefore, if anything is discovered later, if she did check herself before she went down, then we will assume that anything that's on her body afterwards came after going to the mikvah and it won't be a problem. So that's very essential in establishing that chazaka. The going to the mikvah itself, normally it is done the night following Shiva Nikiyam. So in our example, Thursday is the last day of the 7 days. Thursday night, which is really the eighth night, is when she goes to the mikvah. That's the normal process. If a woman cannot go that night, she can't go on the eighth night, then she may go on the ninth night, or on the tenth night. Any night after the eighth night, she can go. If she can't go during the nights, and therefore must go during the day, and this can happen in a place where there is, let's say, a mikvah in a bad neighborhood, or if whatever's going on in her life, it's impossible for her to go at night. Let's say she works at night. So then, a rav should be consulted. A rav can allow a woman to go to the mikvah on the eighth day, the day after she was supposed to go to the mikvah. In that situation, the rav will instruct the woman what to do. There are halachas of yichud that apply then between a husband and wife, different extra halachas that will apply in that case. Going to the mikvah during the day should never be done without consulting with a rav and finding out the intricacies that take place when going to the mikvah during the day. It should be noted that in most communities, the mikvah is anyway under the jurisdiction of a rav, and therefore you can't use it during the day. The mikvah lady is unavailable, the mikvah is locked. And so in most communities anyway, you would have to speak to the Mara de Asra, to the rav in charge, in order to use the mikvah during the day, which is the way it should be. And so that is the general process. You contact the rav of that community if mikvah has to be done at an unusual time and discuss it with him whether this qualifies as a situation which warrants going in at an unusual time and what to do, what the exceptional halachas are in this case. Yeah.
I assume it doesn't matter what if the husband's away for 4 days and her time is that night, Thursday night. And the husband's away on business and will be back till Tuesday.
Right. So the general custom is not to go to the mikvah until he's ready to come home. That's the general custom. There are some Kabbalistic things going on over there. That would be the best thing. If it's not going to work out for her to wait and she needs to go right away, then again, then speak to her about that. But it would be better to wait until he's ready to come home. But once the 7 clean days are over, she no longer has to do any bedikos and she no longer has to wear white underwear. That's over. That's finished. Even if she didn't actually go to the mikveh yet, she's not going for another 2 days. Her husband's out of town, or she can't go. Whatever it is, but she can stop with the white underwear and stop with the bedikos. She's ready to go, and when the time comes, she will go.
Better to wait for the night. If the husband comes home Wednesday afternoon, better to wait till Wednesday night.
Well, that's already that speak to her about which one is better to go the night before. I guess it depends on the circumstance, really. Yeah. It is the minhag. It is the minhag. The minhag is in Klal Yisrael today that we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, that women never go to the mikvah unless they are going for their husbands. That is the minhag in Klal Yisrael. In addition, there are Kabbalistic things going on over there. I don't even want to get into that part of it. But there's you should speak to a rabbi if it's going to be done before. Yeah, a couple of days
is
before.
Is that a general accepted minhag?
Yeah.
Because originally I was talking
so a woman should literally, let's say the husband's in Israel for a month.
And there's no need for, why should she go?
Even go to, she's
not, why should she go to the mikvah? Yeah.
So wait till the next time.
Yeah, yeah. No reason to.
Okay. Another answer for Andy's question. For Sparty, I heard that if the husband comes back the next day, after the wife goes to the mikvah that night, she can sleep with a knife under her pillow.
And that's what I didn't
want to
say.
You know, for Ashkenazi, that was a question.
Yeah. Yeah. The Hapra told us that also. He said if she goes, she goes before husband's around, then she should sleep with a knife under the pillow. Not that he didn't say to us that she could do it and could put a knife under her pillow, that she shouldn't do it, but if she does do it, then she should put a knife under her pillow. That's what he told us.
There are other suggestions
that we're looking
at.
Okay. Sorry,
that's the story of the nap station. The other suggestion is that
okay, so this gets into another discussion, which we'll get to as soon as we just make sure we finish this part about going to the day and the night. And again, if there are extenuating circumstances, always speak to a rav. You never know what a rav may be able to pull out of his hat if he really has to. So always speak to a rav if there are extenuating circumstances. Rabbi Hapfer, who trained me, told us about cases where a woman was flying to Eretz Yisrael the night that she was supposed to go to the mikvah. What do you do then, etc.? And then she's going to get to Eretz Yisrael, and where's she going to go when she gets there? So there could be some very wild cases, and they should be discussed. A woman's making a chasana for her child the night that she's supposed to go to the mikvah. So now what? I mean, so there's various circumstances that could come up. Always speak to a rav if there are some strange things going on.
Make up a schedule for 4 p.m.
Oh boy,
that's worse than it.
Right. Now, Dr. Mitchell asked about, again, say it again.
Yeah, sorry, you know what the date is going to be.
Right, okay.
You're asking you how does it fit.
Okay.
So
this really works on both sides. We talked about before that a woman can't go the night she's supposed to go. Well, why not? Why can't she go? So is she out of town? What's the reason why she can't go the night that she's supposed to go? If at all possible, it is a mitzvah for her to go at the proper time. I don't mean tefillah bezman a mitzvah, which is, you know, that's when they go on. That's not what I'm talking about. But it's still a mitzvah for her to go at the proper time to make herself committed as early as possible. Every rav is sensitive to that and is trying to make it that a woman can be permitted as much as possible and be prohibited as little as possible. And pushing it off is not the best thing. Now, sometimes a woman has to push it off. Either she needs to, or like you said, the husband's out of town, whatever it is. It is considered meritorious for a husband and wife to try their best to both be available at that time. That she be able to go to the mikvah and he be in town, that would be the best thing. You can't always control your schedules. If you travel for work, you can't always control it. But is it meritorious to change the dates so that you could be home? Of course it is. But that always has to be weighed with what are you losing by coming home. But there's no question that it is considered to be a laudable thing for a husband to make sure that he's home the night that she's supposed to go to the mikvah, and that a wife makes sure that she's available to go to the mikvah on that night.
Actually, that was one of the reasons I was given as to why the woman should go to the mikvah on the night, even if her husband's out of town.
Because if he changes
his schedule and he comes home unexpectedly, then you have a big problem.
Okay. That can be, if it's possible that he may change his schedule, then no question, she should go to the mikvah.
Right.
But I mean, you know, if he normally goes away for a week and he's not going to be back, you know, so a woman knows whether it's there's a possibility or not. So that would be the best thing to do. The mikvah going in general should be something that nobody else knows about, but those who have to know about it. Why? We talked about this last week, because it is not tznius, it's not considered modesty, for anybody to know when a husband and wife are going to engage in marital relations. That's the reason why the mikvah night should be hidden from people, because it is a mitzvah to engage in marital relations the night that a woman goes to the mikvah. So, therefore, that should not be known. Now, I say not known to anybody who doesn't have to know about it. There are several people who do have to know about it. Obviously, besides the husband and wife, the mikvah lady has to know about it. Any other woman who the woman meets at the mikvah is going to know about it. And if you have to ask a shayla anytime during the Shiva Nikim, which is very, very common, then the rav is going to know about it. There's nothing wrong with those who need to know about it to know about it. That's nothing wrong. That's not a lack of tznius, because there's a need to tell the person you're telling. Similarly, you may be uncomfortable with this, but if you are visiting someplace and you are a guest at somebody's home and your wife needs to use the mikvah, and in order to do that she needs to speak to the hostess, that's also acceptable because she need. How else are you going to be able to use the mikvah without talking to her? Or I've had this happen on several occasions. Parents or in-laws are visiting, or we are visiting parents or in-laws, and a wife needs to use the mikvah. And the only way to do that, because it's a large family gathering, whatever it is if somebody covers for her. Somebody's got to be there to make up some excuse or whatever it is. So to inform a mother or a mother-in-law or a sister-in-law, preferably married, shouldn't be discussed with an unmarried sibling, then that would be perfectly acceptable. Because you're telling somebody for a tachlis, for a reason. As long as there's a reason involved, it's in order to be able to facilitate going to the mikvah, that is acceptable. So one should not take this too far. I have had situations where someone has come to ask a shayla, he's shown me a cloth, and doesn't want to tell me what day the cloth is from. Because they don't want me to know, because you're not allowed to tell, because you're not supposed to tell what it's coming from. That's taking it too far, because sometimes the Rav needs to know, because sometimes it affects the question. So it's not a problem to share the information with those who need to know it. And it's not uncommon for Rav to get a shayla from the mikvah. The mikvah lady will call up and say, I have this situation. Can she go to the mikvah? There's a problem here, etc. That can happen. It's not a problem when the Rav needs to know. But unnecessarily, it should not be told to anybody.
You mentioned an unmarried sister or something. What about when you have a family and you have already older teenage daughters who are very aware of what's happening in the area? They know very easily if mom's not available or things like that. What's happening? Is it better?
It is better if they don't know. It's better if they don't know. That is the best thing. It's clear from the Gemara that the daughters did know. That is clear from the Gemara. But in those days, things were run a lot differently than they are today. But it would be best if they did not know. You have to be a little creative sometimes. The excuse, Rabbi Feldman, the question was asked, if you have an older daughter, teenage daughter, etc., and she's very aware of what's going on, so then the question is how much to hide it from her, etc.
I agree that it's not wise for kids, even adolescents, to be aware of mikvah night. But if hiding means going through extremely elaborate, deceptive, massive methods that are very possibly going to be discovered, then it undermines the whole thing. You know,
because teenage girls are very aware of what's happening in the house.
Yeah, they seem to have a special electronic front, particularly. It's true,
you just have to deal with that.
You got to deal with it. The thing is, as much as that, it's a bigger problem than it ever used to be, because kids are not properly equipped to deal with what's involved in intimacy. They're polluted and distorted very much. Unless there's other stuff we can do about it, so it's not a great idea to have that event in their heads.
Such as during the day, it's better prepared during the day when there's nobody in the
house.
I'm saying even still, much more so that people don't know, what the kids don't know.
Or else take a bath every single day for a month.
Yeah. If somebody's got to be, needs to know about it, is it preferable that if you had a choice, is it preferable that it's a woman or a man, or does it matter?
Women deal with it better. And men are almost always totally clueless. Even men, and maybe this is only me, even men who deal with these shilas can be totally clueless. I remember one time that I was in, I was visiting my in-laws, and my brother-in-law and sister-in-law were there as well. And my sister-in-law, my married sister-in-law, came to davening on Friday night, which was totally strange for her to come davening on Friday night. Like, it was like really weird. And I actually made jokes about it. Like, it's really weird. 6 months later, my wife told me, where were you thinking? What do you think she was doing there? Because the mikvah was in the shul on Friday night. What do you think she was doing there? Right? But me, who gives these classes, who's dealing with it, I had totally clueless. Over my head completely. Totally missed it. So men almost always will miss it. I mean, I'm just less observant than most, but I think men
exactly.
are going to miss it. Okay, so men are going to miss it. You know, or the time that my wife wasn't wearing makeup because she was going on Friday night. We were with my in-laws, and she had told my mother-in-law because we needed her to cover for us. And my father-in-law spent the whole meal on Friday night commenting how my wife looked like a little sick. You know, like you know, are you not well? You know, because she wasn't wearing makeup, so she didn't look like her normal self on a Friday night. So, you know, totally oblivious. Totally oblivious. So, you know. It's usually easier if you tell a woman than telling him.
Well, no, I didn't say what's easier. I'm just asking what's
your problem. It's usually that will work better.
In terms of sneeze, not in terms of who's going to be aware.
Yeah.
But if you have to, and there's only, your brother's there.
If you have to. Look, I mean, in my understanding was, when I was being taught, I was told that in Lakewood, it wasn't uncommon for a woman to ask her next door neighbor to watch the kids while she goes to the mikvah. You know, that can happen. If you're telling someone who needs to know, it's not a problem. But you want to minimize that. You don't want to spread it around for any reason that isn't necessary.
Collect some stories.
Yeah.
We had two occasions on the Seder night for my wife had to go. And we had not from relatives coming to the Seder, and we had to come, you know, first of all, I got to tell them where she was. It worked out.
Right. So it happens. You know, that's all. Okay. That's the mikvah. Any specific questions about a chatzitza of some sort, something that would be a separation between herself and the water, a rav should be consulted. There could be different things that could come up, and there are extenuating circumstances about medical things. A woman could have a cast or something along those lines. Always a rav should be spoken to about how she's be able to go to the mikvah when there are things that can't be removed from her body. Yeah?
Let's say for some reason her night was Thursday night, but she can't go till Sunday. Whatever, maybe some medical or something. Does the rules of separation with husband and wife are exactly the same until she goes in there?
Yeah, that does not change.
Until she goes to the past and all the past.
Yeah, that does not change.
Just like she was
in there. Right, until she goes to the next one. That's right. That's a good question. Okay, the last part, and we really don't have that much time left, but the last part is Vestas, which is the laws of calculating when she's going to get her next period. And that will impose certain restrictions on a husband and wife when those days come out. Now, the calculation can be somewhat complicated, and I'm assuming everybody has at one point or another been instructed about these calculations, or at least the wife has, so there is some knowledge of it. But in most cases, there are 3 days that you have to calculate. And they are the Yom HaChodesh, which means the date of the month. That's number one. There's the Ona Beinonis, which means the average time that a woman gets her period. And then there is the Yom HaFlaga, which is the interval time between periods. So it's really a lot easier to do this with a chart. I should have made copies of a chart and given it out. But what we'll do is as follows. We will use, it's easier for me to use the Hebrew dates. If everybody's more comfortable, I can use the English dates as well. But with Hebrew dates, it works out easier because of the Yom HaChodesh, because of the date of the month. And so, if a woman gets her period, let's say that a woman gets her period we're in Shvat right now. Let's say Tu B'Shvat. Okay, there's a nice, easy date to remember. The 15th of Shvat, she gets her period. So, if she gets her period on the 15th of Shvat, then the first date to calculate will be the 15th of the next month, which is Adar. The 15th of Adar will be the Yom HaChodesh, the date of the month. The Ona Beinonis, which means the average time that a woman gets her period, there is a machlokas, how much time that is. The most posts can go with 30 days. I'm assuming that's what we'll use. Okay, so 30 days from the 15th of Shevat, you count 30 days, and that will be the Ona Beinonis. That will be another day. However, the count goes, you start with the day that she got her period. So the 15th of the month will be day one. This is a little bit confusing. We're not used to counting that way. So the 15th of the month will be day one. Shvat has 30 days in it. So if counting the 15th of the month, there are 16 days in Shvat, from 15 to 30, even though 30 minus 15 is 15, but you count the 15th of the month. So it's 16 days of Shvat, leaving another 14 days of Adar, for a total of 30 days. 16 plus 14 is 30. So therefore, one calculation, one date will come out to the 15th of Adar, the other one will come out to the 14th of Adar. Those two dates will now be will be a time that we calculate the possibility she may get her period. And the other one is Yom HaFlaga, which means the interval between periods. To do that, you have to calculate when she got her period last time. So this time was the 15th of Shavat. When did she get it? The previous month, which is Teves. And if you calculate that, for argument's sake, that there were 34 days between the last period and this period, you'll count another 34 days, and that will be the Yom HaFlaga. That will be the other date that needs to be factored in. Those three dates. Now, frequently, these dates will overlap, so that instead of getting 3 days of Vestos, you may only get two, or sometimes even only one. It depends on how the dates work out, but sometimes they will overlap. When the day of a Vest comes, so that means that she got her period on Tu B'Shvat, so now we calculated the 14th of Adar and the 15th of Adar, so when she gets to those dates, then there are going to be several things that need to be taken into account. Number one is that marital relations are prohibited on those days. Now, when during those days? So, it depends. If she got her period on the 15th of Shavat, on Tu B'Shvat, at night, then marital relations will be prohibited from sunset to sunrise. If she got her period during the day, then the vest will be from sunrise to sunset. Now, most poskim will say, and I guess there's a rule about adding on the previous 12 hours. Okay, most poskim will say that even if it's only a daytime vest, in other words, she got her period during the day, so technically only the 14th of Adar during the day and the 15th of Adar during the day are prohibited, but because we're concerned that a woman isn't so regular, that even the last time was during the day, perhaps this time will be at night, one should add on the previous 12 hours, and therefore 24 hours will be prohibited. In this case, because it's 24 hours followed by 24 hours, it's 2 dates in a row, it will end up being a 48-hour time of separation from the nighttime of the 14th till the nighttime after the 15th, which is the 16th. That would be those 48 hours.
Do you know if there was a rule for Yom HaKodesh and a Flaga? Or just Yom HaKodesh?
We were told only one of those two.
Which one were you told? If you were told only one, it would be the Ona Benedis. That would be the one.
That's how they hold me?
Generally, yeah.
Okay. So then only for that day. That would be the 30th day, which in our case would be the 14th of Adar. That would be the day that would get an additional 12 hours before the actual vest. The Yom HaKodesh will then only be those 12 hours itself.
So that day, there's a separation.
Right.
And
there's a separation for that day. Now, the separation is only from marital relations and from sleeping in the same bed. Those would be the separations. It is meritorious to abstain from hugging and kissing as well.
So what happens if she's still...
Well, we'll get to that. Hold on. It's in the Shach. Okay? Now, in addition to separating and abstaining from these things, in addition to that, she needs to do two bedikos on the time of the vest. I'm not talking about the previous 12 hours, but the actual time of the vest, which means if it's a daytime vest from sunrise to sunset, she needs to do two bedikos, which would be just like the Shiva Nekiyim, one after sunrise, one before sunset. Or if it's a nighttime vest from sunset to sunrise, she does one after sunset, and one when she wakes up in the morning, even if it's after sunrise. Whenever she wakes up in the morning, she does the second of the two bedikos. If those bedikos are clean, and the day has passed, then she's permitted to her husband until the next one of the vestas.
If she misses the bedikos?
Then she can do one, it depends which one. If it's the Yom HaChodesh,
then now it's the next night.
So hold on. If she missed the Yom HaChodesh, but she didn't bleed, it's okay. If she missed the Yom HaFlaga and she didn't bleed, it's okay. If she missed the Ona Beinonis, she didn't do bedikos for the Ona Beinonis, then she is prohibited to her husband until she does one bedika. So the Ona, she can do whatever she wants. But if she missed the Ona Beinonis, she may not have marital relations with her husband until she does at least one bedika. That's the 30 days. That's the most stringent one. 30 days is the most stringent one. So on that one, we tack on the extra 12 hours, and there, if she missed doing either of the bedikos, meaning if she missed both bedikos. If she did at least one, she's okay. She should have done two. If she did one, she's okay. If she didn't do any, then she needs to do one before being with her husband again.
Just so I don't lose you from too far back. So you have to plug out one.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's a cost positive of having a half day. You talk about if it's night, the other one's a night, the day done today, what if you had it?
We count.
30 and a half.
We count by calendar date.
Okay.
So even if the half plug, which is a very good question, what Dr. Obener is asking is that if she got her period on the, what do we say, on the, sometime in Teves, she got her period in during the day, and then in Shvat she gets it at night, it's not 34 days, it could be 33 and a half days. But we will go with the calendar date. So if it's 34 calendar dates, we will count 34 calendar dates.
Four. And two will separate. If you had bled at
you will
night
use,
the last time.
You will use the most recent one.
Okay, so if you bled at night the last time, 34 days, and you separate.
And night. That's right. That's
otherwise
right.
It would be the day.
And the Arzur would attack on the previous day. That's right. The previous 12 hours. That's right. That's right. Now, if she gets through all of her vestas, everything, and she's okay, and she didn't bleed at all, and she did the bedika, then she's permitted to her husband. You do have to bear in mind that she's eventually going to get her period. So that you do have to keep that in mind, and if she's showing signs that she's about to get it, then you want to be careful. What does it mean to be careful? So, there are different, the poskim will say different things in that sort of situation. If she's starting to stain, for example, but she didn't actually get her period, then you want to ask a shayla before having marital relations, because you don't know. I mean, you don't want to be caught in the middle. So that's something just to bear in mind, that if she's showing signs of it, then to just to be aware of that. But otherwise, she is permitted if she went through the vestas and it was okay. Now, there can be variations and complications in the vestas if she has what is called the vest kavua, which means that she has shown some regularity every 30 days or every same date of the month. If she shows some sort of pattern, then you should ask a shayla, because the pattern may have developed and then the halacha will change of how to calculate the vestas, and it can get somewhat complicated. So most women today don't demonstrate any kind of pattern, in which case there's no issue, but there are a minority of women who do have some sort of a pattern, and then it should be... Okay, the pill does create a pattern. It's an artificial pattern, but does create one, and then a rub should be consulted, because sometimes that would be considered to be a vest kavua, depending on exactly how it's done.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I understand the question, which usually is a bad thing, but I was told to ask after pregnancy. I assume that a lot of that concept just probably ever happens. I mean, you have been 9 months since your last period, and you even...
There's no haflaga. Right? I mean, the first time she gets her period after pregnancy, then she only has two dates to calculate, not three. It's only after she gets her second one, now you have a haflaga to do it. That is correct. That's correct. Yeah. Anything else? Okay.
You mentioned stain. Is it stain as we talked about before? If it stains, then you have to go to...
Right. I'm sorry. I meant if she was staining, but it did not render her prohibited. She stained on colored clothing like we talked about last time. It was uncolored, so therefore it didn't mean anything. It wasn't a flow of blood. It was a stain. You don't even know if it was red. It was just, but you see she's having discharges. So then, if you're concerned that she's about to get her period, that should be taken into account. Yeah. Okay, very good. So Rabbi Feldman is going to take it over, but in a different format.
You still thinking?
Yeah.
Be careful not to walk on this side. Yes, Chicago was asking. So I wanted to talk about some very specific aspects. Actually, Rabbi Kransky touched on them pretty directly, but very briefly, and I want to elaborate on it a little bit. Regarding the whole relationship of a husband and wife around the mikveh, around preparing to go to the mikveh and around the mikveh itself. I want to address
based on my own anecdotal experience with people, what I think is a developing phenomenon in individual marriages, which means I don't mean developing in trends in Klal Yisrael, but the kind of thing that develops over time in a marriage. And that is that if there ever was, at the beginning, a sense of partnership around the fulfillment of the dinim of Taharas HaMishpacha, meaning asking shilas and preparing for the mikveh and coordinating preparations for the mikveh, and also I would include in that the designation of Leil Tevila, of the mikveh night, as something significant and special. If there ever was that partnership at the beginning of the marriage, it's very, very common that people slip into a, a very unfortunate division of labor, where it's almost as if a woman is abandoned to the plight of the mikveh laws and preparation for mikveh and becoming ready to go to mikveh and going to mikveh. It's her problem. And at Leil Tevila, at that point, that's where the husband somehow comes back into the picture. Which means that I find very often that women either are alone in asking shilas, and they have to ask shilas alone, and they don't feel that they have the partnership of their husbands and approaching a rug with shilas. Or they don't ask shilas, the women. They don't ask shilas at all because it's not worth it. And they don't even know that they have access to another resource called their husbands. And so it's very important for husbands to realize that this is obviously a two-party system, that the preparing for mikveh is a critical part of the relationship between husband and wife, that the husband's interest and participation in the shilas and preparing for mikveh actually is more than just helping somebody who needs help, but it's actually a demonstration of the husband's interest in the relationship itself. And it also has repercussions, because when, for example, when a woman feels that she's alone in the whole thing, when a woman feels that she has no partnership, so what she does is she withdraws, she doesn't ask shilas, and what happens when a woman doesn't ask shilas? So women are always much too machmir in laris and in shilas and things like that. So what they do is, whatever comes up, they just say, ah, it's no good, and they go back to zero and start counting all over again. They pass in their own shilas, and they extend the amount of time that husband and wife are physically separate, which is never a good thing. So even though we talked about last time the paradigm of Richuk and Kiruv and the value of relationship of the entire picture, the entire package, and the purposefulness of it, and so on and so forth, but obviously we see from the Dinei Torah itself that the Torah wants husband and wife to be physically together as much as possible. And therefore it's very important during this period of time that a husband make himself available and not absent himself from the whole equation. Another dimension of that same thing I just would want to address is, in other words, there are two types of partnership. In one partnership, the partner, the helping partner, is helping in order to. In another partnership, the helping partner is helping because that's his metzias. That's actually, he's part of his relationship with the wife. It's actually, he's realizing the full extent of his relationship with his wife. So I'm talking really about the latter. I'm not talking about helping in order to, so that the wife won't feel abandoned, so that the wife won't feel alone, so the wife won't be frustrated, so the wife won't take longer to go to the mikveh because she's paskin her own shilas. That's not bad. But I'm talking about something more significant, which is that what's available to the husband in terms of a relationship with his wife, when he does not view the time when she's getting ready for mikveh, the 5 days in the Shiva Nikiyam and Leil Tevila, as something which is her problem to deal with. Particularly when families get busy, it all too often falls to the wife alone to make the whole thing work out. The carpool, the chafifas, the appointment, the whole thing, the babysitting, the husband just somehow there's an unwritten rule that, in many cases, that the husband doesn't play a part in it. And it's not fair, and it's not right, and it's not accurate, because it really is a two-person thing. Both people are really going to the mikveh. Just one actually gets wet. So I want to say some things which are also obvious, but somebody's got to say them. I would encourage you, if it applies to you in any way, to internalize it. Although I could be speaking to myself as well. Over time, people fall into routines. They fall into habits, and the habit is really the death of everything. Right? There are good habits too, but even a person who does the right thing habitually ends up not even becoming aware, not even being aware that he's doing it, and he's not involved. So, the routine of mikvah also becomes a habit. And to the degree that it becomes so habitual that there's not even any overt expression of the significance of Leil Tefillah, the night of the mikvah, that's a problem. So let me approach it this way. I want to base what I'm saying on Chazal. It shouldn't be my opinion. It's not my opinion. I think I'm well grounded in Chazal to say that when Chazal talk about Ona, which means, actually Chazal talk more of Simchas Ona. Yeah, it's very interesting. The word Simcha in terms of a household is used almost exclusively by Chazal when they talk about the mitzvah of a husband to be intimate with his wife. And when the Chazal talk about the mitzvah of a husband to be intimate with his wife, they're talking about the husband's emotional and physical obligations to his wife, which means that contrary to the popular view of the idealized relationship between husband and wife that's designed by halacha, in which the wife, so to speak, has to be available to her husband, is actually the opposite. The husband has to be available to the wife, which means that one of the key dimensions of intimacy is for a wife to feel the interest that a husband has in her, and for a husband to convey that. So Leil Tefillah is obviously the showcase event of that expression of tenderness, intimacy, caring, awareness, connection, and so on and so forth. When it becomes a routine, or actually a problem, where life is too busy, life is too crowded, and now you, wife, are driving me crazy with the burden of, now I gotta help you with mikvah, or whatever it is, and oh no, now I gotta be home, whatever it is, when it becomes that kind of a thing, not only is it unpleasant, but it's also the ultimate destruction of the very mechanics of the relationship between husband and wife. And what happened, don't be fooled, and I'm not even assuming I'm talking to you, I'm just saying this. A husband should not be fooled if one's wife doesn't complain ever about it. Because the worst level of being disregarded is where one doesn't even expect to be regarded. And when one has totally given up, and I see all too often in many relationships where the wife has long ago given up on the idea that the husband will be sensitive, caring, and interested. And so they just go through the routine because they have to. Whatever happens, happens. How it happens, they make no request, they don't ask, and the husband thinks he's free, home free. He's trained his wife not to nudge, right? I mean, I'm aware of these things. So what I'm saying, I'm not making this up. And that is that goes totally against the engineering of marriage, and the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu designed it, and the way Chazal clearly elaborate in it. So it's very important for a couple to take Leil Tefillah very seriously. One of the things I'm looking at, just in case it comes from the mikvah. So that means corny stuff. A husband making sure to find out when is Leil Tefillah in advance, so that he can make arrangements, so that he could be home, so he doesn't come home late after she comes from the mikvah, and she has to wait another hour, an hour and a half, or 2 hours till he comes home, and by then, you know, everybody's frustrated, disgusted, tired, and whatever. So it's very important for people to designate the night as something special, and to take efforts to do something different for a husband, to take some initiative that way. Very, very important to do it that way. There is a notion that I also want to bavarn, so to speak, that when it becomes inconvenient, when the Leil Tefillah is inconvenient, that it's just deflected. And that's really not the way it should be at all. First of all, the couple itself suffers when the opportunity for intimacy is taken so casually that, okay, I'm supposed to go to mikvah Wednesday night, doesn't work out, there's a PTA meeting, can't do it, I have to be there, okay, we'll work, you know, I'll just go Thursday night. And very often a wife might not even tell her husband because, A, maybe he doesn't mind anyway, B, he'll get upset, C, I don't care, or whatever it is. It's easier not to deal with it than to deal with it. So what I'm saying is that is really what it is the couple not honoring their basic commitment to each other and actually acting as if their basic commitment to each other is an interruption of the life that they're leading that is so important. And the fact is there is almost never a time when the Leil Tefillah comes up that it is actually, what a perfect night. Nothing's going on. There's no wedding, there's no Sheva Brachas, there's no Shabbos, there's no guests, there's no kids, there's no meeting, there's no nothing. It's all right. It just doesn't work out that way. No commitments. But this is something that we have to honor. This is something that we have to actually have to treat as a commitment to each other and to the notion of Shalom Bayis. We have to realize that intimacy between husband and wife is—it's not the satisfaction of one person's needs by having available the other person. It's not like, you know, like we have this view of basic need, basic animal instincts or needs that one partner has that the other one is there to satisfy and they have an obligation to satisfy that. It's not that at all. It's something much more significant than that. And it's important for us to once in a while focus. That's one of the reasons that the review during Shavuot is so significant, is because we become aware of things that we already knew that we forget to focus on. I mean, there's a pasuk in Melachim that grabs my attention, in Melachim Beis, that describes the Kadosh HaKadoshim as the Cheder HaMitos Asher Beis Hashem, the bedroom in the house of God, right? I mean, the Cheder HaMitos. It's an amazing description of the Kadosh HaKadoshim. The embrace of the Kruvim in the Kadosh HaKadoshim, right? The chiba between Ish v'Ishto is described as when Ish v'Ishto are together, the Shechina is Shruya b'neihem. At the most intimate physical moments, the Shechina is there. So Shir HaShirim, which is called Kodesh Kadashim, which is written in terms which are descriptive of a physical union between a husband and wife, which really is a description of, in the most accurate possible terms, of the relationship between Knesset Yisrael and a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So we have to remember that we're talking here about a relationship which is filled with potential for Kedusha, and which actually gives us an opportunity to emulate a Kadosh Baruch Hu. The Maral talks about the idea of Yichud, of connection, of being together, as being literally like Dumus Elokus, like being like the image of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, because a Kadosh Baruch Hu, in the Olam HaGashmi, everything is separated. So the Maral says that the separation of husband and wife that's a reflection of the physical world having dominion. And when husband and wife are together, that's already the non-physical world. That's already the spiritual world. It's almost the word he uses, the world of Elokus, so to speak. And so we have to relate to it that way. It's not a design to satisfy sexual needs, although that's there too, absolutely. But that's not the sum of it. The sum of it is something much more significant. As well, there's this concept of inui, that a person who deprives his wife of physical attention is considered to be providing affliction. Right? That's literally the term that's used, which means that it's the teva of a wife to seek and to crave the attention of her husband. And even if that doesn't seem to be the case, that is because the teva of the wife has been so taken advantage of or so not brought out that a woman spurned is, I don't know what the end of the expression is, but it ain't good. Okay. The basic instinct, need, built-in inclination. So it's very, very important for husbands to take this seriously and to nurture that relationship and to invest in it. And the difficulty that we find is actually the area where growth is going to happen the most. Now, to the degree that we find this to be difficult, that's the area in our own psyche that needs attention, and that will actually result in growth when we address it. Now, I want to address one other thing before we close. And what time is it? Okay, good. So we're within the promised envelope here. The following is my opinion. It's not like, you know, I wouldn't say it's grounded in anything. It's an application of a concept in Chazal to something b'zman hazeh. That is this. We find in the various discussions of our Baalei Halacha, and actually in Chazal themselves, we find a significant emphasis on what a person is supposed to be thinking about when he's with his wife physically. And one of the things that's discussed is the aversion in our machshava to a husband having in mind other women when he's with his wife, which means that there's a certain form of kavana in the love relationship which the Torah requires and encourages of a husband, which means that to the degree that a husband thinks that he needs or is interested in other thoughts while he's being intimate with his wife, to that degree, that is not an act of intimacy. To that degree, that is really, he's reducing the act to a physical act and invading it, so to speak, with other forces that are totally alien to the relationship. And when that happens, I would suggest that's a result not of a problem in physical intimacy at the moment, but it's a problem in what's going on in the husband's mind all the time. And I don't mean pornography and all that kind of stuff. I'm talking about the emotional focus. What is the focus emotionally of a husband in terms of his marriage? When a person is focused emotionally and exclusively, I'm not talking about looking at other women, that's another issue. I'm talking about just the emotional devotion, commitment, connection, preoccupation, interest, so on and so forth, with his wife, which is his primary relationship in the entire world, more important than his job, more important than his career, more important than even with his Rebbe in a certain sense. So that is, then that comes out, so to speak, in all kinds of ways. And so, b'zman hazeh, we have a much bigger problem because we have the absolute total availability. Now I am talking about the invasion of pornography and so on and so forth. We have the total availability of every other lowly woman in the entire world is brought straight into our houses free of charge whenever anybody wants. And that is not just a moral halachic problem of los hasturach ve'levavchem v'achareinechem, that you're not allowed to wander after your passions and after your fantasies, which the Torah, by the way, is telling us that every single person will have. You're not supposed to pursue them. But it's not only that kind of a problem. It's also a problem in terms of this devotion, which means that not even lahavdil, in the same way that a Kadosh Baruch Hu demands exclusivity, and we are not allowed to bring in a little bit of Avodah Zarah into the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're not allowed to attribute even a little bit of cause and effect to anything outside of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In the same way, our relationship with our wives demands total exclusivity and commitment, and we're not allowed to bring in other things into that relationship. So there's no such thing as a harmless look at something else, a harmless delving into something else. Which, let's put it in a positive sense. Tznius of machshava, a willingness to focus our thoughts, a willingness to direct our thoughts, and a willingness to sanctify our thoughts, and to treat our own heads and our eyes like a kodesh hakodeshim, like a holy of holies, in which it really matters what goes in, and it matters what we allow to stay in there, it matters what we allow to do it. That attitude will translate into the way that we relate to our wives. And to the degree that we have this hemorrhaging, so to speak, by thinking that there's this harmless involvement with that stuff out there, to that degree we're hemorrhaging emotionally, and to that degree the relationship itself is not whole, and to that degree we have a problem. So I'm trying to draw a picture of a whole package, so to speak, of practical commitment that husbands owe their wives, physical commitment that we owe our wives in terms of physical attention, and let's use a corny word, romance, in the appropriate sense, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, part of this whole thing, the picture of what other things we allow ourselves to be interested in the world that is right now very, very active in invading the holiness of the Jewish home. So I don't know if I've raised any questions or any issues, but that's all I had to say. Yes?
Okay. I agree with what you said completely. But one of the things that, the last thing that you said about the focus, like, with other women and so on, I don't understand it with the idea that the Torah allows a man to have multiple wives. Because if he has multiple wives, if nothing else, he is permitted both women. So I would think that one woman would be a distraction for the other woman.
The women are definitely distractions for each other, right?
No, for the man.
So the thing what I'm leading up to is that a man should only have two wives when he's capable of being totally married to one when he's with her and totally married to the other when he's with her. And that's why we don't generally practice that, because we have a hard enough time being totally married to one when she's the only one, right? So that's really one of the major issues. But the point is, when a husband has two wives, he is totally married to one when he's with her and totally married to the other when he's with the other one. And that's something that's like almost impossible for us to imagine. It takes a tremendous amount of kavanah. Literally kavanah.
Yeah.
It'd be like davening shachar is the guy. What's that? I'm sorry?
So it's another indication of the level we're sunk to. We're talking about the
exactly true.
We can't even imagine it.
Right. We tend to think, exactly, we tend to think of the men back then as somehow free lovers. You know, like these Hollywood guys who ran around with, you know, whatever it is. And we want to understand that it really was a product, it was a result, that was a symptom of a whole mindset that we can't imagine, of tremendous discipline, of being a bailim, of actually being a master of oneself. So that when one is totally involved in what one has in front of him, and that's a different thing. We can't even imagine it. We literally can't imagine it. So you're asking a good kasha, and the answer is we're not up to that. We're not up to that.
I would say we have the challenge with children sometimes.
Like relating to each one, you mean? Yeah.
We should try to designate a night of week. You know, this night I was going out with you. Mm. This Ian was going out with you.
Yeah.
But it's very challenging. So to be there 100% with that one child, so that I can think, because you know, you've got five kids running around. But
yeah.
Different, obviously,
with
the wife.
Yeah.
At the same time,
it's just in parallel. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. It's true. Anything else? Okay. Yeah, Shkoff for being here.
Now it's on hold.
One second.